Welcome to episode 7 of the Metal Hammer podcast. I'm Mo and I'm here with Jonathan and Elle. First time we've had this particular combo, guys.
It is.
How are we doing? What's going on?
I'm doing very well.
Me too.
Quick shout out to Mr. Luke Morton, who is away travelling the world for the next 3 weeks on his lovely little holidays. We'll see him back soon. What have we been doing? Nothing as glamorous as that, have we? Elle, you went to Parkway Drive at the Underworld the other day.
That was pretty...
Friday night.
Hot, yes. Non-glamorous and amazing. Obviously, they're playing massive venues now, like Brixton, and doing festivals, and they didn't bring the pyro or their spinning wheel drum kit.
They probably would have killed people.
But it was basically like a headline set in a 500-cap venue, so it was really sweaty, loads of people stage diving.
Winston, what set list did they do? Because I heard it was going to be quite Horizons heavy.
It was, yeah, it was really Horizons heavy. And they shipped in a couple of the new ones as well. The Void sounded amazing, just decimating. And it obviously ended with Bottom Feeder, and that was insane as well. And it was just, yeah, it was one of those gigs where everyone was just climbing all over each other and getting very excited.
Amazing.
Winston was kind of taking his shirt off, going, oh, I can't believe it, it's so crazy up here, you know, and bottles of water were being handed out to people, and it was just literally one of those shows that everyone's going to remember.
For a long, long time. Sorry, I thought you were going to add a distinct like passage of time then, just for remember, for Ebs.
But yeah, the
for
new,
7 years.
It was very Horizons heavy, but the new material just sounded super cool and everyone was singing already.
It's so telling that they're like ending sets with that now, even when it's kind of a, you know, quote-unquote nostalgia set or whatever. They're really kind of going straight back to the Ayer stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting. Almost like closing a chapter of that band's career in a sense, because it kind of feels like there's really like a pre-Ayer and post-Ayer world for them, and I kind of think the two singles they've released off the next album is, it kind of goes to show that.
Really, I really does. I would really agree with that. I think there's definitely a pre and a post world, and this post world they're moving into is going to be really fascinating.
Fuck yes. Reverence, of course, is coming in May, I think. That's right, isn't it, Elle?
Yes.
Yes, Elle knows. So I can't wait to be hearing that. We'll be going very big on that in the magazine, of course. As well as a special interview with the guys coming up in a future issue of Metal Hammer, so watch out for that. Jonathan, what have you been up to?
Something very different.
Sound like
yeah,
you.
Very different. Yeah. No, the last gig I went to was Anna Von Hauswolf at the Dome.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
It was one of the most powerful things I've ever witnessed. The reverence in the womb, before she came, maybe there's reverence in the womb as well too, who knows? The reverence in the room before she turned up, like, I've never seen a room just go silent, like, absolutely every single soul.
It was the Dome, wasn't it?
Upstairs at the Dome, yeah. Just before she came on. And so she has this voice that's, like, so incredibly powerful. Feels like it kind of comes from another dimension, but it's also otherworldly.
It's kind of like a Chelsea Wolfe kind of vibe, that kind of...
It is. I mean, it's only that kind of sense of, like moving into sort of a realm that's kind of, like, not fully daytime awake, like, more of a kind of, like, semi-conscious realm, or, like, in some kind of more nocturnal realm. You can hear references to Judy Cruz, who was on Twin Peaks and did the album, did this amazing album with Angelo Badalamenti called Into the Night. And so it's just this kind of very mesmerizing but extremely powerful channeling something other in the room, and everyone was just like absolutely just like stunned. And the last song, she came and she kind of walked into the audience, and it was a really kind of truly intimate moment.
Amazing.
And yeah, just like this voice, just it's something else. It's such an incredible voice, but it's also so loud and so powerful and so unique.
Awesome. And if you want to read more about Anna Von Hauswolf, you can of course do so in the current issue of Subterranea, which, if for some insane reason you weren't aware, is the free extreme and underground magazine that comes only with each issue of Metal Hammer. Of course, we've been banging on about that issue all month because it fucking slams, by the way. Features a world exclusive interview with Rob Halford and Tony Iommi, along with the aforementioned issue of Subterranea, plus Conjurer, Aelstorm, Vile Creature, Dave Mustaine, Love Bites, Primordial, Turnstile, Andrew WK. As always, we give you the ultimate spectrum of all things heavy, so get out there and pick it up right now. Just on the off chance, we heard from some of our suppliers that the fuckery of the snowstorm that hit the UK earlier this month kind of hit a couple of outlets. So if you weren't able to go out and pick Hammer up for that reason, they're all fully stocked now. So get out there right now, pick it up. We appreciate your support as always. So that's what you guys have been up to. I went to see Bill Bailey in Watford, which is a slightly different vibe. So yeah, that was fun. He was wicked, yes. Metal Hammer, Golden Gods, Illuminati, we should add, Bill Bailey. And so that was good fun.
Is he still doing references to metal in the show?
He did, yeah, actually. He did. He played Iron Man on cowbells.
That's so good.
Which is pretty cool.
I have long said there are not enough cowbells in metal.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really, really good. Beyond that, there's been a lot going on this week. What the fuck's been happening in... I'm swearing a lot this week. Apologies to those that are offended by swearing. You're probably listening to the wrong podcast, who cares? What's been going on in the world of metal this week, Elle?
Well, Marilyn Manson has teased a video for Tattooed in Reverse featuring Courtney Love as a nurse.
I saw this. Courtney Love and Marilyn Manson. Fans of a certain vintage, definitely very excited by that, I imagine. As I am.
Yeah, it looks super cool. I mean, I think they've been feuding on and off for 20 years or so now.
Sounds about right.
A long time. We were talking the other day, actually, before this came out, about the Beautiful Monsters tour in
1999,
where they were both on there, and then it kind of
Manson
ended early,
Hall.
Didn't it? Because they fell out.
Yeah. It all went to shit, and there's loads of controversy about it. And I don't know how often Manson and Courtney have really crossed paths since then. But it's interesting to see them back together again, and you know, in a video together. It's very speaks to a very kind of exciting and historic era in metal and heavy music history, I think.
I think her being a nurse and Manson being in a wheelchair as well is just sort of classic Manson alternative territory. You know, it's going to be, the video is going to be something cool.
Well, I wonder like how self-aware like it's going to be, like how much they're going to like play off, you know, being themselves.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, they're both very like that. They know how to kind of play off their stereotypes and play off what people think of them. Has Manson sorted his leg out yet? Because when
know.
I saw him in that wheelchair, I was like, "You still fucked? What's going on?"
I don't know. You never know, do you? If it's for theatrical purposes or for a genuine medical reason. I did think it was kind of cool at the show, though, how there's so much medical paraphernalia there. Because I did think, again, if you're a fan of him, there's probably a certain crossover there with medical fetish. So probably going to like that.
Sounds about right. And the Tattoo in Reverse. We kind of started doing this podcast again after the. The album came out, of course, but I think we were pretty in on Heaven Upside Down, weren't we?
Yeah, generally? I loved it.
You did love it, didn't
you? Yeah. I think I was the one who most loved it.
Definitely.
So
yeah.
I think you guys maybe had more measured opinions on it, but I really liked
it. I liked it, but I kind of feel like the reaction to it in general made me realise I didn't like it quite as much as everyone else seemed to. Because it did come across like it went down like not another return to form, but a continuation of the form that the Pale Emperor had him on. But yeah, I wasn't blown away.
Yeah, I think we have different expectations for him these days.
Yes, definitely.
Like, I think, you know, we're just kind of relieved that the album's all right. I mean, I still think Hollywood is a masterpiece.
I think it's, yeah.
And
my favourite Manson album.
And, you know, but it wasn't just about Manson. It was very much part of the era that it came out of. It, you know, had something to say about the era.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't expect that from Manson albums. You just expect Manson albums to be about how's he doing these days. And, you know, rather than anything bigger than himself, and also himself, it seems to have like shrunk a little bit. So it's good for the expectations that you have, but I think expectations for Manson albums have kind of shrunk, and we're kind of relieved when an album's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Interesting to see if maybe we'll see Manson and Courtney back on tour together. Who knows? Although, no, he's going on tour with Rob Zombie again, isn't he, in the States?
Yeah, Twins of Evil.
Okay, another one where I thought they weren't friends anymore because they had a fallout on tour.
They had a fallout on that tour, didn't they, specifically? And
Manson rebuilding some bridges, it seems.
Well, you know, I went to see the when they played the last time at the O2.
Oh, yeah, I was at that gig.
The thing is, there was such a difference between like how they approached their gigs, like the level of professionalism, and, you know, the Manson gig was just typical Manson mess.
It hurts me so much to hear the words typical Marilyn Manson mess. That's horrible.
Yeah, but I saw him, you know...
historically one of the single greatest live acts of all time.
I know, but, you know, I saw him at Wacken, and it all just kind of devolved into... Just random stuff at the microphone, and then everyone saw the next day. Everyone at Wacken saw Alice Cooper, And every single person I spoke to had exactly the same thought. Like, I wish Mattson was watching this.
Yeah.
And this is how you put on a show like that. Mm. And I wish, you know, he'd be a little bit ashamed about, you know, how his shows went.
Yeah, I think you nailed it earlier, really, when you say that our expectations are so low now. I think everyone generally agrees that around the 2009 cycle was when he was at his worst live, when he did that infamous Download performance that was just awful. And yeah, the last few times I've seen him, I mean, we saw him at Wembley on the Heaven Upside Down tour near the end of last year, and it was solid for the most part. The second half was really fucking good. I must not swear, I need a swear jar or something. Sorry. How rude and unimaginative of me.
Little clink.
It was scrumbunctious. No, it was really, really good.
Well, I like the whole set on that tour. I know you were a fan, but yeah, from beginning to end, top to bottom, I was all in.
Yeah, me and Luke actually walked into the crowd to find you belting along. So it might have been Tattooed in Reverse, actually, all of the new stuff. So yeah, fair play. But anyway, it's always fun to see like genuine legends of the game working together. So we'll see if it goes anywhere beyond this. Lamb of God are doing something, but we don't know what.
Yeah, there's a clip online of Randy walking down a corridor, and he walks into a room that says 6A on the door, and that is it.
And it says something about Burn the Priest as
well.
It does, which
is tomorrow's
Lamb of God's original name.
Today's date, Friday's date. Friday's date. That's the date.
Friday's date.
Friday's date.
This is going out Thursday. So yeah, tomorrow there'll be something big coming in Lamb of God world, and you might want to keep an eye on that. And on some other stuff coming up in Metal Hammer's world when it comes to that as well. So very, very exciting times. Also, I'm going to make Jonathan say this because you told us something just before we went on air.
Okay, well, I've got other stories, but Nine Inch Nails have announced a show at the Royal Albert Hall after the Meltdown show.
Yeah, so 2 Nine Inch Nails London shows, one on South Bank in the, do you know what building it is?
Royal Festival Hall.
The Royal Festival Hall. And then, yeah, following it up with a show at the Royal Albert Hall, which I presume will be pretty spectacular, really. I can't imagine what Trent will have planned for that.
No, I mean, it's such a special venue. When people play there, they know they're going to have to bring something special because that venue has so much history and it's such an interesting setting and a historical setting that you don't usually just get a normal gig there. You get a performance.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see what he does. And sorry, I didn't really need to make an example of it, but Jonathan just revealed that he wasn't actually a big Nine Inch Nails fan, which did surprise me, actually.
And I'm not sure we can be friends anymore.
Well, first, let me say that I did actually, must have been late 90s, spend a week driving around Europe watching them play in a van. What happened? I had a friend he had this kind of squat, and his squat mate was in a band called Pig, an industrial band called Pig, who was supporting them. So I think I'd just gotten back from some other trip from my old magazine, and I got a phone call saying, like, do you want to get in a van, drive around Europe for a few days, see Nine Inch Nails? I was like, yeah, when? You need to leave in about half an hour. So basically, drove
around. Adam Spice is so unimpressed right now.
Basically, enjoyed the gigs. I mean, got in a van, drove around like Paris, Germany, Luxembourg, watching.
Did you say Luxembourg like
yes,
that?
Yes, I said Luxembourg. Yeah. No, it's just a tiny little country.
With really deep vocal people? Or?
Yeah. I can't even remember if they played Luxembourg. I just remember like one of the places we drove through. So it's an amazing journey, trip, and yes, got to see them play about three times throughout that week. But things like I grew up sort of in like late 90s when it was there was loads of amazing industrial music. It was like for me it was like Front 242 and Skinny Puppy, and that music was really really intense and. And Nine Inch Nails were kind of the next generation on, and I felt I didn't kind of need them in the same way that I kind of had my fill of these other bands. Like, there was this whole kind of original electronic body music scene was huge in the late 90s, and I was obsessed with it. And and there were so many like stupendously original bands, but also they talked about kind of global things, and Nine Inch Nails were more about kind of like a bit more personal. And I always liked bands that were more about your kind of existential plight rather than like personal diary kind of things. And so I kind of felt that Nine Inch Nails were a little bit less ambitious in some ways than the bands like Front 242 or Skinny Puppy or bands of that ilk.
Wow. Yeah. Barely heard Trent Reznor described as unambitious,
I know.
I've got to say.
I know.
The award-winning Trent Reznor. Yeah. No, I think
as he shall always now be introduced.
I think that's really interesting. And I can see that they're really valid points, because I came into Nine Inch Nails not having any of that background. And I heard bands like Skinny Puppy afterwards, and to me it was just a less good version of what I enjoyed about Nine Inch Nails, because yeah. I had experienced things the other way around. And I guess just to address the ambitious point, he was like a guy who helped out in a studio, who entirely built his own project, and that's pretty admirable. And he's gone on to then build his career up and up and up, going from being this kind of self-destructive one-man band type of guy to scoring major films and collaborating with people and opening his music up to the rest of the world. So,
well,
yeah,
I mean, I've got nothing to add to either of these. I think I sit in the middle of Nine Inch Nails, so you can just
how do you sit in the middle though?
Well, I think they are a brilliant, seminal, ambitious.
I think I've probably been ambitious in one very specific way. Yeah, it probably wasn't the best choice of words.
That's right. I don't need to sit here and say Nine Inch Nails were good, but they were never my band. Like certain other bands were. I mean, if we want anything even loosely in that realm, I'll fall on my sword for Marilyn Manson as an artist, but I won't probably go to bat quite so hard for Trent just because he's not my guy.
Because I mean, in like the 80s and the 90s, in the late 80s actually, industrial was something very different, and it came from kind of very different roots. It came from like bands like Throb and Gristle, who were really, really avant-garde. And originally, when industrial music was the term was coined, it was actually ambient music.
That's really fucking weird. Because listening to the first time I heard Throb and Gristle, I was like, where did this come from? What depraved mind thought this up? How am I supposed to actually listen to it for more than 10 seconds? I want to die.
I can't listen to much Throb and Gristle either, but there were other bands around that time like SPK who were really good. But it's just that, you know, there's a long history of industrial music that and I just think when bands like Nine Inch Nails come, I'm sure they listen to those original bands, but it felt like a bit of a year zero.
Is that a pun?
No pun intended. Well, fair enough. One thing that was quite interesting about the Nine Inch Nails shows that have been announced is obviously the South Bank show they're playing is a part of Robert Smith curated Meltdown Festival, which has got Deftones are on it. Who else are on it?
Placebo, Mogwai.
Yeah, Mogwai.
Not Twist. Basically,
someone really rubbish as well that I can't remember.
They just went into my mind during my dreams. I just pulled everything out of my brain.
Yeah, it is an absolute Hellfest. And I know, I saw that, we all kind of talked about it in the office, that a Meltdown actually tweeted at one of the big kind of ticket reseller sites saying that their tickets weren't going to be valid.
They
Which one
did.
Was it?
They tweeted it via GoGo.
Right,
and they said
GoGo.
It's against their terms and conditions to sell tickets above face value for profit or commercial gain. So because the South Bank Centre is, I'm not sure exactly what the funding structure is, but it's essentially a big arts complex that does a lot of work with communities and it has those principles where it has to adhere to certain standards. You know, it's not just a for-profit organisation as far as I'm aware.
Mm. Interesting. It'd be interesting to see if they can actually put that into action. Are they going to be able to realistically block off any tickets that have been sold through a third party site? Because this is a big problem for a lot of fans now. You kind of regularly see, especially with the bigger shows, tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. through official big league sites. They're all sold out by 1 minute past, by 2 minute past. They're appearing on another third party site for 300% plus inflated price. So does it look like the Meltdown are actually going to be able to do anything about the people that have these tickets or not? I don't really know if it's a...
I don't know. I've not seen any follow-up to that. I'm not sure logistically how it works. It's something that we will probably investigate down the line. You know, we've looked at in the magazine before about how ticketing companies work and what action is being taken to make sure reselling is fair. And this really just feeds into that ongoing debate. I'm not sure exactly how the South Bank Centre will address this, but I'm really interested to find out.
Interesting.
Because I'm sure it's like, you know, it's not even a level playing field, because I'm, you know, in the same way that you get, I'm sure, like, you know, they're being bought by bots. I'm sure there's, like, you know, there are certain technologies that, the ticket buyers use to just get in there really quick.
That I can't speak for any specific sites, obviously, but there, you know, there have been investigations into this already by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport and places like the BBC, and some businesses have access to the back end of the websites, and they have special tools they can use in order to purchase tickets and then sell them on through their own businesses. So there are practices like that that do happen.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, there are companies buying and selling shares in, like, you know, microseconds. You know, when it's all kind of computerised.
And anecdotal advice as well suggests that this does happen super quickly. Like you said, you know, people logging in to try and get a ticket are sitting in a big queue and miss out on tickets, and then a few seconds later they go on a resale website and they see tickets on there. So there's a lot of talk at the moment about how and why that is happening, because you can literally see it happening when you're trying to buy tickets yourself.
Yeah, it's really odd. I think, as Elle said, it's something we've covered in Mount Hummer before, but it was probably the better part of a couple of years ago that we last took a real investigative look at it. So we're going to kind of look further into this and reach out to some of those ticketing companies for an answer on what's going on there and how that whole process goes around, because we appreciate that there's a lot of very unhappy fans in the scene at the moment about this kind of stuff coming up again and again. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with some answers on that very, very soon.
I think the last update was in November from the government that they're continuing their investigations, that they're going to go and talk to these companies. So I think we just kind of have to watch and see what the results are going to be from that.
Cool. All right. Well, we will do that. So stay tuned. We'll have some. We'll try and get some answers. But if not, we'll definitely look into it a little bit for everybody. What have the wonderful readers of the Metal Hammer Facebook group been asking us this month, everybody?
Well, related to the discussion we just had.
Oh yeah, that was timely.
Ben Wilmot says, "What are your top three Nine Inch Nails albums?"
I think you're gonna have to take this, Elle.
Can we get some love for Year Zero in there?
Would Year Zero make your top three? I like Year Zero.
I should have thought about this earlier. I don't know. I feel under pressure now to deliver my definitive three albums.
Far as less covered ones go, I'm a big fan of With Teeth as well. I think that album's great.
It's very danceable, that album, when it came out. It was sort of quite
that's
unexpected.
Why I like it. I'm a bit of a dance nerd on the side, so that struck a chord with me.
I like what he did with the soundtrack for Natural Born Killers. That, you know, that was kind of, it was experimental, but the bands he chose for it were really well thought out, by people like Jim Manic Alas. I remember being on that, and it was kind of like a weird sort of tape mix.
Yeah, absolutely. I like him when that kind of stuff happens.
Yeah, I like the fact that he, you know, he's kind of branched out into kind of more ambient territories as well.
Yeah, definitely. I'm a big fan of his stuff in that realm. Right, Elle, what are you saying?
Oh, I just can't decide.
Well, isn't it Downward Spiral your number one? Or is that predictable?
No,
that's too obvious.
I think Downward Spiral is my number one. And then maybe Pretty Hate Machine. And then maybe... then maybe...
Feeling quite standard, you need a wild card.
Probably Year Zero.
There you go.
And I don't know, it's really hard, because I think Year Zero isn't necessarily the best choice for a third album, but I really liked the campaign and the concept behind it, and the way he tried to make it bigger than an album, and the way he was going to sort of set up a TV show for it, and the teaser campaign for it. But in terms of wildcards, I'd probably say I really am a big fan of the live album and All That Could Have Been. I actually asked for that from my parents for an Easter present, because at some point in our lives...
Hold on. Easter present?
Yeah.
What? You don't get presents for Easter.
At some point in my life, for some reason, my parents decided that, you know, they could buy us an Easter egg or they could buy us a present for Easter. And so,
how much were the Easter eggs you were getting? 15 quid?
I don't know. It was just one of these weird things where they sort of kind of went, yeah, you know, would you like a present for Easter? And I was like, yeah, kind of like Nine Inch Nails live album, which is not Easter-y whatsoever.
No.
Nothing Christian about it.
I can't believe you got the choice at Easter to choose between a bit of chocolate or a live album.
Well, I didn't really get a choice. It was more just kind of, I really wanted and All It Could Have Been. My dad kind of said, yeah, we'll buy it for you for an Easter present. And I remember just being really excited getting it, because it came in that, like, grey slipcase and just looked really mega cool. Yeah. And it was It's my favourite live album. It's so exciting. You just feel like you're there, and I just used to listen to it over and over again. So I feel like that should be in my top three somewhere, actually, even though it's not a studio album. So maybe Downward Spiral and All That Could Have Been, scooping up quite a few songs on that record.
Yep.
And then maybe...
Pretty Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a wrong answer. Sorry.
If any of my family are listening are thinking of getting me a chocolate egg for Easter, I'll have a vinyl instead, so it'll be nice. There's a nice Lord of the Rings box set, I quite fancy, so I'll take that instead of an Easter egg, because that's a fair trade. Andrew Cleary says, do you think deluxe albums are a con to squeeze more money out of fans for an extra few songs that could have made the album anyway, or do you like the idea of them?
I've noticed they're doing them less. Like, I remember a few years ago, you get like an album and then like, you know, it'll come out on CD, and then 6 months down the line or 3 months down the line, you get the deluxe version with like four extra tracks.
The Roadrunner Digipacks.
Yeah.
Iconic.
Yeah, and those seemed a bit of a con. And, you know, I think both people wise up to them. I think when people started buying music online a lot more, listen to Spotify or Apple Music, that became a bit redundant because they weren't artifacts. And I think now, you know, a lot more bands are doing things like box sets, which I love. I love having a proper box set, and
yeah, me too.
And I don't feel you know, that's like a, you know, it's part of my emotional investment in a band, so they're very different. So you're getting much fewer of those now.
Yeah,
those kind of deluxe versions that kind of hit you like 4 months later.
Well, I used to hate that, like you, when I was buying CDs, and then I would buy it, and then a few months later, it would be like, oh, now I need to get this and get the extra tracks. But I really like it now when on Spotify you're listening to a record and extra tracks just come on.
That happens annoys to me. The piss out of me sometimes.
Oh, I like it. I think it happens to me the last Korn record. At one point I was listening to it and there were extra tracks and I was like, there's new Korn songs, and for some reason I just not noticed.
It annoys me when they're bonus tracks that are stuck in weird orders, or the only version they've got of a certain album is this weird massive deluxe thing. But I mean, the way people are listening to music has changed now anyway, and actually a lot of bands sell albums online through iTunes, which I think is changing anyway now, isn't it? But things like that, people do it. People do create albums in a way that they sell tracks over a kind of completed piece, and it does give fans the opportunity to, you know, buy select tracks or just stream select tracks or whatever.
I kind of hate that idea.
Yeah, it's a
old-fashioned albums person.
And I think, to be fair, most metal fans in general are probably more likely to be album oriented than fans.
I like it when albums are conceived as albums. I mean, you couldn't put like, let's say, a Nick Cave album and have like one track out of context of any particular album, or have it mixing with one other album, because they're so unique to the atmosphere and the spirit of that particular album. And I think, you know, all our favourite bands, you know, the albums could only be made at that particular time, and they're self-contained things. And if people start thinking just in terms of like single tracks, you lose that, you know, it might just go purely for the immediacy side of things, and you lose that sense of either the photographication or how you put space in an album. You lose that sense of dynamics, and everything becomes much more kind of, might be, you know, more snappy, but it's not going to remain in time as a body of work.
Yeah, I think also as well, it's probably worth pointing out that depending on which artists and bands you're talking about, I mean, to me, the idea of squeezing money out of fans is a bit redundant in an era where the mass majority of bands don't make money out of music. You know, like if a band, especially a metal band, I mean, the amount of metal bands that can make legitimate, actual, livable money out of their music itself is tiny. And I think at the end of the day, if a band feels that they can earn a little bit extra here or there by putting out some deluxe records of people, I think in this day and age, that's not...
No, but is it who's making the money? Is it them or is it the label?
Very good point. It depends on the band.
Yeah, and it depends on the deal as well, because, you know, a lot of people were signing these things called 360 deals, where the labels had a certain cut of the merchandising as well.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a lot of the time you get, you know, how many times have we seen spurious kind of greatest hits sets get put out mid-cycle because a band's got to deal with a label that they need to release something else on and all that kind of shit.
But this also ties in the third year of the albums as well too, with merchandising. It's like the ones that seem to like sell the most merchandise and do really well out of it are the bands that kind of created their own entire world. That once you step in, you know, you're in that world and no one else's. So you know, like Amon Ra and Batushka are like merchandising monsters. Like you know, and it makes sense that you know, you kind of want a piece of that particular universe that you feel, you know, a part of. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something for all bands to think about as well too. Is just create your own universe and you'll sell more shit because of it as well too.
Excellent advice from a reviews editor, right?
But you know, it's the level of attachment people have to things that make them buy loads of stuff.
Of course. Do you want to take this next question, Sals?
So on the back of the Shinedown and Godsmack US co-headline tour being announced this week, what's the single worst gig/tour you've ever had to review for work or been dragged along to for whatever reason?
Who asked that?
That was from Elliot Holt.
Well, Elliot clearly does not like Shinedown or Godsmack. I can't say I blame him. Actually, on that note, I don't know if a lot of English fans are aware of just how big some of those bands are in the US, but I went to Chicago Open Air last year and I saw the crowds that both Shinedown and Godsmack had, and fuck me, they love that stuff out there. It was wild. They literally fill arenas.
Yeah, it's all that honking earnestness. American
honking earnestness.
Worst gigs then?
Yeah, so the first thing that came into my head, because I was there in a work capacity, was there was a band around about probably 5 years ago now called Broken Side. Do you remember them?
I do.
Yeah, I can't remember what that whole scene was called. Crunk, that was it. Crunk core. Bunch of white guys with awful haircuts, kind of rapping. I mean, I'm wearing one of the Jules t-shirts, so I don't have a problem with hip hop or rap music when it's done well. But a bunch of really gawky little kids rapping over these shitty kind of post Skrillex mixed with metal bullshit. And it was just, I think they played, I want to say the Barfly, and I think half their band didn't turn up, so it was just two dudes and a fucking backing track in front of like five people going meh, and it was diabolically bad. And thankfully that band have not been heard from since on any meaningful level.
Funny enough, the worst band I've seen live in recent years was a similar band called Kate Moss.
That was recently, wasn't it?
Yeah, Sporting Horror.
Kate Moss with the dollar signs.
With the dollar signs, yeah. And it's...
How modern.
Just, yeah, when people want to rap and they can't rap, it's the most painful thing in the world. It's like seeing a comedian die on stage. And they had this whole kind of concept that would seem to have a whole concept, but it was just the most shoddy, desperate thing I've ever seen in my entire life. They had this... other singer struck down, so kind of stripped down to her thongs, and it's not even in any way titillating. It's just like, you could smell the desperation coming off of it, and it seems such a like a New York thing, and it probably makes sense within two blocks of New York and nowhere else outside of it. And they just got booed completely, and Horror came on and said like, "Man, I'm totally into this shit. This is art," and it. But the difference in quality between Horror and them was so incredibly vast.
Yeah.
And they kind of undercut any kind of sympathy you might have had for this band.
Absolutely.
I think one of the first 0 out of 10 I've ever given.
Richly deserved. Yeah, shout out Horror as well.
Every single of that zero is richly deserved.
massive props to Horror as well, by the way.
Brilliant band. Proper punk spirit.
Yeah, exactly. L, worst thing you've ever seen on a stage?
Well, I started writing about gigs when I lived in Sheffield, and I wrote for this local magazine called Sandman, and every few weeks they would send around an email of bands they wanted covering, and you could just reply with the ones that you were into, and then they would send you off to go and review these gigs. So one day I got this email and I didn't recognise any of the bands on the list, so I just picked one of them and thought, I'm just going to go along and review whatever this is. And it was at a local pub called The Grapes, and it had a tiny upstairs room where you could just go and watch bands. And it was a really weird one because sometimes you get people just going for bands and sometimes you just get the clientele of the pub. It was mostly old beer-drinking men that were just going upstairs for something to do.
Of course.
So I just turned up one night, went upstairs for this gig, didn't know what I was getting into. And it just turned out to be like three blokes on a stage with three chairs. And it turned out to be this really weird performance art where they would just walk around the stage and like scrape these chairs along the floor and make moaning noises. And they did it for about 15 minutes. And then after that, they got like dolls. And then they just started blowing into the bums of these dolls and making noises.
Okay.
And I just did not know what to make of it. I don't remember.
Oh,
it was years ago.
I was going to go look them up.
I'll have to find out and let you know. But it was just really surreal. I just didn't realise what I was going to. And there were only about five people watching and no one knew what to make of it.
Wow.
It was super weird.
Well, if you're listening and you just happen to be one of the dull bumhole blowing people in that band, get in touch so we can block you and never think of you again. How utterly, utterly bizarre. What else are the lovely people of the Metal Hammers Readers group on Facebook, which you can go and join right now, asking us?
So, Alec says, make a band consisting solely of Discworld characters.
Oh, that's so niche. What a nerd.
Yeah.
My man, I can do this. I'd have Death on bass. I'd have Sam Vines. No, I'd have Sam Vines on bass, Death on lead guitar, Mort on vocals, one of the Weird Sisters on drums, and the Librarian on keyboards. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go read Discworld because it's amazing.
I'd have a Drone Doom bed consisting solely of the Turtles. Discworld on there.
That's awesome. Cool. Shout out, Alec, for what must be the geekiest question we've ever had, but I'm into it. What is this? Just a random childless loser from TJ. That's a username, by the way. Says, thinking about the Faceless situation, I think that's a kind of band members endlessly leaving and coming and going and all that kind of stuff. What memorable bands beside Megadeth have changed almost all their members but managed to make a lasting impression in the metal scene? I mean, first and foremost, most bands go through significant lineup changes. Like any band that makes a big impression on in metal has probably gone through a lot of changes over the years. There's a few exceptions.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's when everyone suddenly leaves en masse, like Sabaton.
Oh yeah, that
happened. Yeah, and I mean, they seem to do quite well out of it because I guess it was so much based around Draken.
Yeah. I mean, I think as long as you've got his voice on there, and you know, someone that can write a galloping heavy metal song about war, then Sabaton are always going to be alright.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the most notable example of this happening recently is Ghost, of course, where the Ghouls all pissed off. And there's kind of a bit of a public fallout and there's some lawsuit going on and all that. And actually, I think Ghost is the best example for this. To me, as long as you've got the main creator and visionary of the band still there, then the heart and soul of the band is still intact. And that remains to be seen with Ghost, of course, because we'll see what this next album brings. But yeah, I think they're a good example of a band that have done great things. So we'll see what happens when this next album comes.
Yeah, I mean, there are some bands that you just can't imagine them losing a member, because you know, there's a band like Such a Gang, whether it's like someone like Neurosis or Watain or something, or mm-hmm. you know, where there's bands like, it's so much about the one between the people in the band.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of any other bands that have lost so many members.
Sepultura have still forged out a formidable career after Max and then Igor left. You know. They're still going strong. They played, I think, the Forum maybe the other day.
Yeah, I mean, there are bands who kind of go off and do different, like they have a big split and they go off and do different things and goes, yeah, I like this bit, but if you put them two together, you get something that's kind of more than some of its parts. Like my favourite metal album of the first decade was a band called Liguria Bunja and a band called Om, and it's one of the most beautiful records I've ever heard in my entire life, like a black metal record. They kind of had, the two main guys had a falling out. One continued Negru Bunja, the other, who passed away, Sadik Negru, and the other started a band called Dordudu. And they were great, they're both really good, but just like not as good as the band together. Like they both siphoned off one aspect of the original band.
Yeah, of course.
But having like these aspects together, it creates something that's, you know, you can't get it with any other kind of configuration of members or what have you.
Fair enough. Any to spring to mind for you, Earl?
I think you covered the main ones. I think you made a really good point about the visionary being there, because I think when you do see bands losing singers, that's really hard to deal with, and you get a lot of kickback from fans, and depending on how involved they were with the writing process, bands can still survive that, but sometimes it's really difficult to get over that hump of identifying with a different voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at someone like Marilyn Manson, what became a very stable lineup that changed a little bit in the 90s kind of became a revolving door of characters, really. And in his case, that's come to mostly diminishing returns. I mean, I think the days where it was Manson, John Five, Twiggy, Gingerfish, M.W. Gacy, like that was a real powerhouse lineup of musicians. And then he kind of brought in Tim Skold for a bit when they did God Knows You're Grotesque, which I think is a brilliant album. And then since then, it's all gone a bit odd. So I think it just honestly depends on whose vision, yeah, like I said, whose vision it is, who's kind of steering the bus for everybody, and how influenced they are to start with by everyone else around them.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember Amen? I'm sure every time Case of Chaos came back, it was with a band, with a completely new band.
Yeah, of course.
But again, he was such a driving force, and some bands you never really know unless you really delve into it who the other musicians are. You literally know who the singer is, and that's it, and everyone else just blends into the crowd. Whereas, like you said, with Manson, when you've got people with personalities and identities, it is much harder then to break from those.
Yeah, it's interesting though. It's like with some bands, like, you know, if you can lose all the members, it's clearly, one thing you obviously don't have is, like, say, a signature guitar sound. Like, you know, can you imagine, like, Enslaved without Isdale's guitar riffs? And so it's, if you can lose all those members, it suggests you're lacking something that's
good
point to that band.
It's a really good point.
Yeah,
you know, like, you know, so many of the great bands, it's between the singer and some unique guitarist or who has a particular, like, you know, can you imagine Jane's Addiction without Dave Navarro? You just can't do it.
Very, very true.
Or Guns N' Roses without Slash. Whoops.
Well, we don't have to worry about that anymore, thank God. Yeah. And Charlie's Democracy was a great album. I don't care what people say.
I actually like at least a third of it. It's much better than I thought it was going to be.
It is. All right, that is all for episode 7 of the Metal Hammer podcast. Thank you very much for listening in and supporting us as always. Don't forget the aforementioned magazine is out right now. Go pick that motherfucker up. I swore again. Jesus.
That's all right.
Stop it, Merlin.
I know, but I just, you know, when the clock is
like the angel and the devil on your shoulder. Swear again, don't swear.
God, I'm going to do a swear count for next episode. I'm going to not swear next week. Jeebus. Anyways, heavy metal, fuck it. Don't forget the magazine's out now, go pick that up. The Metal Hammer Tour featuring Trivium, Code Orange, Venom Prison and Power Trip is basically days away. Three of those bands already ripping up across Europe as we speak, and all four will hit the UK in April. It's going to be brilliant. Get on there and get your tickets while you can. I think it was above 80% sold across the UK when we checked last. Very, very good. On next week's show, we will be not only unveiling the brand new issue of Metal Hammer, it's a doozy, believe me. We will also be announcing, in a world exclusive, all the nominees for this year's Golden Gods. It is back, it is bigger than ever, and it's going to be fucking epic. We will see you then. Ta-ra, everybody.
Bye.